Then what, Sebes? He said, if the uneven were necessarily indestructible, wouldn't three be indestructible? Of course. And if the unhot two were necessarily indestructible, then whenever someone brought heat against snow, the snow would withdraw safe and unmelted. It wouldn't be destroyed, nor would it stay put and take in the heat. True, he said. And in the same way, I think, if the uncoolable were indestructible, then whenever something cold advanced on the fire, it would never be put out or destroyed. It would go off and depart intact. Necessarily, he said. Then aren't we compelled, he said, to say the same about the deathless? If the deathless is also indestructible, it's impossible for the soul to be destroyed when death comes against it. For by what we've said, it will not accept death and will not be dead, just as three, we said, will not be even nor will the odd, just as fire will not be cold nor the heat in the fire. But what prevents this, someone might say? The odd doesn't become even when the even advances, that's agreed, but what prevents it from perishing and an even thing coming to be in its place? Against someone who said that, we couldn't fight it out and insist that it doesn't perish, for the uneven is not indestructible. If that had been agreed between us, we could easily have argued that when the even advances, the odd and the three go off and depart, and about fire and the hot and the rest we'd have argued the same way. Isn't that so? Certainly. So now about the deathless. If we agree that it's also indestructible, then the soul, besides being deathless, would be indestructible too. But if not, another argument would be needed. But none is needed on that account, he said. Hardly anything could refuse destruction if the deathless, which is eternal, is going to accept destruction. And the God, I think, said Socrates, and the form of life itself and anything else that is deathless, everyone would agree these never perish. Everyone indeed by Zeus, he said, all human beings and still more I imagine the gods. Then since the deathless is also imperishable, what else could the soul be, if it really is deathless, than indestructible as well? It must be, absolutely. So when death comes against a man, the mortal part of him, it seems, dies, while the deathless part goes off and departs safe and undestroyed, yielding its place to death. So it appears. Then beyond all doubt, Sebes, he said, the soul is deathless and indestructible, and our souls really will exist in Hades. For my part, Socrates, Sebes said, I have nothing further to say against that and no way of doubting the argument. But if Simmias here or anyone else has something to say, it would be well not to keep silent about it. I don't know to what other occasion than the present one a person could put off speaking or hearing about such things, if he wants to say or hear anything at all. But indeed, said Simmias, I too no longer have any grounds for doubt given what has been said. And yet, because of the sheer magnitude of the subjects the argument concerns, and because I have a low opinion of human weakness, I find myself still compelled to hold some private doubt about what has been said. Not only that, Simmias, said Socrates, but you are right to say so, and even our first assumptions, trustworthy as they seem to you, still need to be examined more clearly. If you take them apart thoroughly enough, I think you will follow the argument as far as it is possible for a human being to follow it, and if that itself becomes clear, you will look for nothing further. That's true, he said. But here is something, gentlemen, that it's right to think through. If the soul is immortal, it needs care, not only for the time we call living, but for all time, and the danger of neglecting it would now indeed seem terrible. For if death were a release from everything, it would be a windfall for the wicked to die, being freed at once from the body, and along with the soul, from their own wickedness. But since the soul plainly is deathless, it has no escape from evils and no safety, except by becoming as good and as wise as possible. For the soul goes down to Hades possessing nothing else at all but its education and upbringing. And these, it is said, help or harm the dead person the most, right from the very beginning of the journey to that place. And this is how the story goes. When each person dies, the guardian spirit that was allotted to him in life undertakes to lead him to a certain place, where those gathered must be judged, and then travel on to Hades with the guide appointed to conduct people from here to there. Having there met with what they must meet, and having remained as long as is required, another guide brings them back here again, after many long cycles of time. But in fact, the journey is not as the Telephus of Aeschylus describes it. He says a single path leads to Hades, but it seems to me neither single nor simple. If it were, there would be no need of guides. No one could ever go astray if there were but one road. As it is, it seems to have many branches and forks. I judge this from the rites and customs practiced here. Now the soul that is orderly and wise follows along and is not ignorant of what confronts it. But the soul that clings to the body with desire, as I said before, flutters around it and around the visible world for a long time, and after much resistance and much suffering, is led away by force and with difficulty by the spirit assigned to it. And when it arrives where the others are, if it is impure and has done something of that sort, if it has been stained with unjust killings or committed other such acts, sister deeds done by sister souls, everyone shuns it and turns away, unwilling to be either its companion or its guide, and it wanders alone, gripped by utter helplessness, until certain periods of time have passed, and when these arrive it is swept by necessity into the dwelling that suits it. But the soul that has passed through life in purity and moderation, finding gods for companions and guides, settles each in the place fitting for it. For there are many wonderful places on the earth, and the earth itself is neither of the kind nor the size that is commonly supposed by those who habitually talk about it. Of this I have been persuaded by someone. And Simmias said, "What do you mean by this, Socrates? I too have heard a great deal about the earth, but not the things that persuade you, so I'd be glad to hear." Well, Simmias, it doesn't seem to me to take the skill of Glaucus just to narrate what it is, but to show that it's true seems harder to me than the skill of Glaucus could manage. And at the same time, I probably wouldn't be capable of it. And even if I knew how, my life, Simmias, seems to me too short for such a long account. Still, nothing stops me from telling you the shape I am persuaded the earth has, and its regions. Well, said Simmias, that much will do. I am persuaded then, he said, first, that if the earth is round and lies in the middle of the heavens, it needs neither air nor any other such force to keep it from falling, but that the uniformity of the heavens with themselves in every direction and the equilibrium of the earth itself are sufficient to hold it up. For a thing in equilibrium, set in the middle of something uniform, will have no more reason to tilt one way than another, but being in the same relation all around, it will remain untilted. This, then, is the first thing I am persuaded of. And rightly so, said Simmias. Further, he said, that it is enormously large, and that we who live between the pillars of Heracles and the river Phases inhabit only a small portion of it, dwelling around the sea like ants or frogs around a pond, while many other people live elsewhere in many such regions. For everywhere around the earth there are many hollows of every shape and size, into which water and mist and air have flowed together. But the earth itself lies pure in the pure heaven, in which the stars are, which most of those accustomed to speak of such things call the ether. Our world is the sediment of that ether, always flowing together into the hollows of the earth. So we who live in these hollows are unaware of it, and think we live up on the surface of the earth, just as if someone living in the middle of the ocean floor thought he lived on the surface of the sea, and seeing the sun and the other stars through the water, took the sea for the sky, and because of his slowness and weakness had never reached the surface of the sea nor ever risen up out of the water to look out at our world here and see how much purer and more beautiful it is than his own. Nor had he heard this from anyone who had seen it. This is exactly our condition. Living in some hollow of the earth, we think we live on its surface, and we call the air heaven, as though it were the true heaven through which the stars move, when really, through weakness and slowness, we are unable to pass all the way through the air to its outer edge. For if someone reached its summit or grew wings and flew up, he would look out and see, just as fish here, poking their heads out of the sea, see the things of our world, so he too would see the things up there. And if his nature could bear to go on gazing, he would recognize that that is the true heaven, and the true light, and the true earth. For this earth of ours, and its stones, and this whole region here are corroded and eaten away, just as things in the sea are by the brine, and nothing worthwhile grows in the sea, nor is anything there, one might say, complete, only caverns and sand, and endless mud and slime, wherever there is earth at all, and nothing there measures up in beauty to what we have here. but that world up there would show itself to be far more superior still to ours. In fact, if it's fitting to tell a tale, it's worth hearing, Simmias, what things are like on the earth that lies beneath that heaven. Well, Socrates, said Simmias, we would certainly be glad to hear this tale. It is said then, my friend, first that the earth itself, viewed from above, looks like one of those balls stitched from 12 pieces of leather, many colored, marked off in patches of color, of which the colors we have here are like samples, the sort painters use. There the whole earth is made of such colors, and far brighter and purer ones than these. One region is sea purple and wonderfully beautiful, another gold-colored, another white, whiter than chalk or snow, and made up likewise of the other colors, even more numerous and more beautiful than any we have seen. And even these very hollows of the earth, being full of water and air, present a kind of color, gleaming amid the variety of the other colors, so that the whole appears as one continuous, varied surface. And in an earth of this kind, the things that grow, grow in proportion, trees and flowers and fruits, and the mountains too, and the stones, have in the same proportion a smoothness, a translucence, and colors more beautiful, of which the small stones we prize here, carnelian, jasper, emerald, and all such, are fragments. But there every stone is like this, and even more beautiful still. The reason for this is that those stones are pure and not eaten away and corroded, as ours are, by decay and brine flowing down together here, which bring disfigurement and disease to stones and earth alike, and to the other animals and plants as well. And the earth itself is adorned with all these things, and further with gold and silver and all such other things besides. For these lie exposed to view by nature, being many in number and great in size, and scattered everywhere over the earth, so that to see it is a sight for the eyes of the blessed. And there are many other living creatures upon it, and human beings too, some dwelling inland, others along the air as we do along the sea, and others on islands which the air flows around, close by the mainland. And in a word, what water and the sea are to us for our needs, the air is to them there, and what air is to us, the ether is to them. And their seasons are blended in such a way that they are free of sickness and live for a much longer time than people here. And in sight, hearing, wisdom, and all such things, they are as far superior to us as air is purer than water, and ether than air. They also have groves and temples of the gods, in which the gods truly dwell, and they have oracles, prophecies, and direct perceptions of the gods, and such communion with them face to face. And they see the sun and moon and stars as they truly are, and their happiness in every other respect matches this. Such then is the nature of the whole earth and of what surrounds it. And within it, arranged around its whole circuit, are many regions in its hollow places, some deeper and more open than the one we live in, others deeper still but with a narrower opening than ours, and some shallower in depth than ours but broader. All of these are connected to one another underground by many passages, some narrower, some wider, and have channels through which much water flows from one into another as if into mixing bowls. And there are immense rivers of water, hot and cold, flowing forever beneath the earth, and great rivers of fire, and many rivers of liquid mud, some purer and some filthier, like the rivers of mud that flow ahead of the lava in Sicily, and the lava stream itself. From these, each of the regions is filled in turn, as the circular flow happens to reach each one at each time. And all of this moves up and down like a kind of swing set within the earth, and this swinging motion comes about, in fact, through some such natural cause as this. One of the chasms of the earth happens to be the largest of all, and it runs straight through the whole earth. The one Homer describes when he speaks of it as far off, where the deepest pit lies beneath the ground. This chasm, both Homer elsewhere and many other poets, have called Tartarus. All the rivers flow together into this chasm, and flow out of it again, and each takes on the character of whatever kind of earth it flows through. The reason all the streams flow out from there and back into it again is that this fluid mass has no bottom and no floor to rest on. So it sways and surges up and down, and the air and wind around it do the same thing, for the wind follows along with it both when it rushes toward one side of the earth and when it rushes toward the other. And just as with people breathing, the wind that flows there is always being breathed out and breathed in, so too, swaying together with the fluid, the wind produces terrifying, uncontrollable blasts as it goes in and out. So whenever the water withdraws to the region called the lower one, It flows into the channels on that side and through the earth and fills them, just as people do when they pour water through irrigation channels. And whenever in turn it leaves that side and rushes toward this one, it fills the channels here again. And once filled, these flow through their passages and through the earth, and arriving each at the places toward which they've been channeled, they form seas and lakes and rivers and springs. From there they sink back down through the earth again, some circling through longer and more numerous regions, others through shorter and fewer, and empty back into Tartarus, some far below the point where they were drawn off, others only a little below. But all of them flow in below the point where they flowed out, and some come out on the opposite side from where they went in, others on the same side. And there are some that circle all the way around, coiling once or even several times around the earth like snakes, before plunging down as far as they can and emptying in again. It's possible to go down as far as the middle from either direction, but no farther, since beyond that point, the ground rises upward for streams flowing from both directions alike. Now besides these, there are many other great streams of every kind. But among this multitude there happen to be four in particular, the largest of which, and the one that flows in the outermost circle around everything, is called Ocean. Directly across from this one, flowing in the opposite direction, is the Acheron, which flows through desolate regions and, running underground, reaches the Acrusian Lake, where the souls of most of the dead arrive, and after remaining there for certain appointed periods, some longer, some shorter, are sent out again into the births of living creatures. A third river empties out between these two, and near its outlet it pours into a vast region burning with much fire, and forms a lake bigger than our own sea, boiling with water and mud. From there it moves in a circle, thick and muddy, coiling around the earth until it reaches, among other places, the edge of the Acrusian Lake without mixing with its waters, and after coiling many times underground it empties still lower than Tartarus. This is the river they call Pyriphlegethon, and its offshoots are what spout up as streams of lava wherever they happen to break through the earth. Directly opposite this one, the fourth river empties first into a place terrible and wild, they say, colored entirely like dark blue steel. The river they call the Styx, and the lake formed where it empties Styx as well. After plunging in there and taking on fearsome powers in its water, it sinks under the earth, and coiling around moves opposite to Pyriphlegethon, meeting it from the other side in the Acrusian Lake. And its water too mixes with nothing, but it also circles all the way around and empties into Tartarus opposite Pyriphlegethon. Its name, as the poets say, is Cocytus. Given that these things are arranged this way, when the dead arrive at the place where each one's guiding spirit brings them, first they are judged, those who lived well and righteously, and those who did not. Those judged to have lived a middling life travel to the Acheron, and boarding whatever serves as their vessels, arrive on these at the lake, and there they dwell and are purified, paying the penalty for any wrongs they've done and being released from them, and receiving rewards for their good deeds, each according to merit. But those judged incurable because of the magnitude of their crimes, having committed many great sacrileges, or many unjust and lawless murders, or other such things, these are hurled by their fitting destiny into Tartarus, from which they never emerge. Those judged to have committed curable but serious wrongs, say, striking a father or mother in anger and then living the rest of their life in regret, or becoming a killer in some similar way, these must fall into Tartarus. But after falling and spending a year there, the current casts them out again, the killers by way of Cocytus, those who struck father or mother by way of Pyriphlegethon. And when, carried along, they come opposite the Acrusian Lake, there they cry out and call, some to those they killed, others to those they wronged, and calling out, they beg and plead to be allowed to come out into the lake and be received. And if they persuade them, they come out and their sufferings cease. But if not, they're swept back again into Tartarus and from there again into the rivers, and this keeps happening to them until they persuade those they wronged, for this is the sentence the judges set upon them. But those judged to have lived an exceptionally righteous life are the ones who are freed and released from these regions within the earth, as though from prisons, and arrive above at the pure dwelling place, settling upon the earth's surface. And among these, the ones who have been sufficiently purified by philosophy live thereafter entirely without bodies, and arrive at dwellings still more beautiful than these, which it isn't easy to describe, nor is there time enough right now. For the sake of all we've gone through, then, Simias, one must do everything possible to have a share of virtue and wisdom in this life, for the prize is fine and the hope is great. To insist that these things are exactly as I've described them wouldn't suit a sensible man, but that something like this, or something of this kind, is true of our souls and their dwellings, given that the soul plainly is immortal, this seems to me both fitting and worth risking belief in, for it's a noble risk, and one should say such things over to oneself like a charm, which is why I've drawn out this story so long. For these reasons, then, a man ought to feel confident about his own soul if throughout his life he has dismissed the other pleasures, the ones concerned with the body and its adornments, treating them as foreign to him and more likely to do harm than good, and has instead thrown himself into the pleasures of learning, adorning his soul not with something foreign but with its own proper ornament, self-control, justice, courage, freedom, and truth, and so awaits his journey to Hades, ready to set out whenever fate calls. As for the rest of you, Simias and Cebes and everyone else, he said, each of you will make that journey at some time in the future. But now already, as a tragic poet might put it, fate is calling me, and it's about time I turn to my bath. It seems better to bathe before drinking the poison, rather than giving the women the trouble of washing a corpse. When he'd said this, Crito spoke up. Well then, Socrates, what instructions do you have for these men or for me about your children or anything else that we could carry out for you most gladly? Nothing new, Crito, he said. Just what I always say, that if you take care of yourselves, whatever you do will be done as a favor to me and mine and to yourselves, even if you make no promises now. But if you neglect yourselves and refuse to live, so to speak, following the tracks laid out by what's been said both now and in the past, then no matter how much and how earnestly you agree now, it will do no good at all. We'll certainly try hard to do as you say, said Crito. But how shall we bury you? However you like, he said, provided you can catch me and I don't slip away from you. And laughing quietly and glancing over at us, he said, I can't convince Crito, gentlemen, that I am this Socrates here, the one now talking with you and arranging each point of the discussion. He thinks I'm that other one he'll see shortly, a corpse, and he's asking how to bury that. And all this that I've been saying at length, that once I drink the poison I'll no longer stay with you but will be off and away to some blessed state of happiness. All this, it seems, I've been saying to him for nothing, meant only to comfort you and myself at once. So please stand surety for me to Crito, he said. The opposite kind of surety from the one he offered the jury. He pledged that I would stay. You pledge that I will not stay once I'm dead but will be gone and away, so that Crito can bear it more easily and not be distressed on my behalf when he sees my body being burned or buried, as if I were suffering something terrible, or say at the funeral that he's laying out Socrates, or carrying him out, or burying him. For you should know well, my good Crito, he said, that speaking carelessly isn't only a fault in itself, but it does some harm to the soul as well. No, you must have courage, and say that you're burying my body, and bury it however you please, whatever way seems most proper to you. Having said this, he got up and went into another room to bathe, and Crito followed him while he told us to wait. So we waited, talking among ourselves about what had been said and going over it again, and at other times dwelling on the calamity that had befallen us, feeling quite simply as though we were about to live out the rest of our lives deprived of a father, like orphans. When he had bathed and his children were brought to him, he had two small sons and one older one, and the women of his household arrived. He spoke with them in Crito's presence and gave instructions about whatever he wished, then told the women and children to leave and came back to us himself. It was now near sunset, since he had spent a long time inside. He came in and sat down, freshly bathed, and there wasn't much conversation after that before the attendant of the 11 came in, stood beside him and said, Socrates, I won't have the same complaint against you that I have against others, that they get angry at me and curse me when, following the orders of the officials, I tell them to drink the poison. But you, I've come to know in this time as the noblest and gentlest and best man of all who have ever come here, and now especially I'm sure you're not angry at me, but at those responsible, for you know who they are. So now, since you know what message I've come to bring, farewell, and try to bear what must be borne as easily as you can. and bursting into tears, he turned and left. Socrates looked up at him and said, "Farewell to you too, we'll do as you say." And turning to us, he said, "What a civilized man. The whole time I've been here, he's come to see me, and sometimes talked with me, and been the best of men, and now see how nobly he weeps for me. But come, Crito, let's do as he says. Let someone bring the poison if it's been prepared. If not, let the man prepare it." And Crito said, "But Socrates, I think the sun is still on the mountains and hasn't set yet. And besides, I know others who have drunk it quite late, well after being told to, and have eaten well and drunk well, and some have even had time with whomever they desired. Please, there's no need to hurry, there's still time." And Socrates said, "That's reasonable enough, Crito. The men you're talking about think they gain something by doing it that way. But I have good reason not to do it myself. I don't think I'll gain anything by drinking a little later, except to make myself look ridiculous, clinging to life and sparing a life that has nothing left in it. Come now, do as I say, and don't do otherwise." Hearing this, Crito nodded to the slave standing nearby. The slave went out, and after some time returned with the man who was to administer the poison, carrying it ready ground in a cup. When Socrates saw the man, he said, "Well, my good fellow, you understand these things, what should I do?" "Nothing," the man said, "except drink it and walk about until your legs feel heavy, then lie down. It will act on its own." And with that, he held out the cup to Socrates. He took it quite calmly, Echecrates not a tremor, no change in color or expression, and looking up at the man from under his brow the way he always did, he said, "What do you say about pouring a libation from this drink to someone? Is that allowed or not?" "Socrates," the man said, "we grind only as much as we judge the right amount to drink." "I understand," he said, "but surely it's permitted and right to pray to the gods that my journey from this world to the other be a fortunate one. That's my prayer, may it turn out that way." And with these words, he raised the cup to his lips and drank it down, quite readily and without any trouble at all. Up to that point, most of us had been fairly able to hold back our tears, but when we saw him drinking and that he had drunk it, we couldn't hold back any longer for my part. The tears came pouring down against my will, so that I covered my face and wept for myself, not for him, but for my own fortune at being deprived of a companion like that. Crito had gotten up even before I did, since he couldn't hold back his tears either. Apollodorus, who hadn't stopped weeping even before this, now burst into loud sobbing and anger, and there wasn't a single person present he didn't break down except Socrates himself. He said, "What are you doing, you strange men? It was mainly for this reason that I sent the women away, so they wouldn't behave so improperly. I've heard that one should die in reverent silence. Be calm and be strong." Hearing this, we felt ashamed and held back our tears. He walked about, and when he said his legs were getting heavy, he lay down on his back. That's what the man told him to do. And the same man, the one who had given him the poison, kept his hand on him, and after a while examined his feet and legs, then pressed hard on his foot and asked if he could feel it. He said no. After that he pressed his shins, and moving upward like this he showed us that he was growing cold and stiff. He touched him himself and said that when it reached his heart he would be gone. Now the coldness had nearly reached his abdomen when he uncovered his face he had been covered, and said these were his last words, "Crito, we owe a rooster to Asclepius, please pay the debt and don't neglect it." "It will be done," said Crito, "but see if you have anything else to say." To this question he gave no further answer. After a little while he stirred, and the man uncovered him, his eyes had fixed and were staring. Seeing this, Crito closed his mouth and his eyes. That, Echecrates, was the end of our companion, a man who, we would say, was of all those of his time whom we ever knew the best, and also the wisest and the most just.